Testing. Oh, it's alive. Good, good, good. Well, good afternoon. As we were chatting earlier, only three lectures left to go, including today's. So let me talk a little bit about our plans. Today and next week, I'll be talking in detail about the code generation notes that I've been distributing. Last time I handed out assignment 5 for those who hadn't looked at it yet, and also code generation notes 1. So I think I have some extras of those. Let me check that. So who needs notes section 1? And does anybody need a copy of assignment 5? That's the code generation assignment. Okay. And what I didn't hand out yet, and I'll be doing right now, is part 2 of those notes. There's also parts 3 and 4, which you can print out in advance if you want to. It's on the webpage, or I'll make copies and distribute them next week. My estimation is I'll do 2 sections today and 2 sections next time. And then for the final week, there'll be some remaining code generation topics that I'll bring up. Some of these could tie into extra credit for assignment 5, and they may also be issues that were mentioned on old exams. And then we'll also do a review of the old exams. I think that week, the week of the last lecture, we'll have, I think, what our final exam first sitting would be on a Thursday, I believe. And then we'll have office hours on Monday, and the second sitting will be on a week later, the next Tuesday. And that effectively will be the end of the class, except for the grading and distribution of grades, assuming we can get the TA to go into high gear. Otherwise, you know, you can put in your last will and testament who you want your final grade sent to when and if it ever comes out. Seems kind of odd, but there's a situation that always boggled my mind is, I'm sure many of you are familiar with Walt Disney Company. You may have been to Disneyland or Disney World. But actually about 10 years ago, the Disney Corporation sold 100-year bonds. That is, you give them your money now, and they'll pay you interest year by year, but you don't get your money back for 100 years. And I was wondering, you know, under what circumstances would probably never an individual or an organization would buy that far in advance. The United States government only goes 30 years in advance, and that's, you know, it's a major part of someone's adult life. So it always, and these things sold well, the 100-year notes. So I was always wondering, you know, who is looking 100 years from now? So I know, so assuming it was done in 2010, in 2110. That's so far in the future, that's almost Star Trek days. Somebody actually has a calendar out there about in human years, normal 19, 20, 21, 22 years, what Star Trek events happen. So you could maybe, you know, meet Captain Kirk and sign on to the Enterprise. So these are chapter 2, so don't grab one if you already printed one out. Otherwise, we'll just start them around. one of the issues that came up in last office hours and also in just other conversations is people were concerned if they didn't have their assignment 4 completely done, would that block them from doing assignment 5? Fortunately, the answer is no. For the most part, the error checking components aren't of interest anymore in assignment 5 because we're only going to ask you to co-generate correct programs. So what's important for part 4 is that you set the types and kinds in the symbol tables and in the various AST nodes properly, because code generation may ask, what's your type? Because depending on the type of a particular expression, you'll generate one choice of code or another. So anything, you know, having to do with symbol tables, add information, that's one of the things you probably did pretty early. So if that's working, you're fine, even if there are some cases where some odd combination of errors you don't detect or something happens. If you want to see a solution on that, we'll talk about that, but that part of it is pretty much passed. Now we're only worrying about generating code for correct programs. In fact, I have a few slides here, and then we'll be getting into sections 1 and 2 in some detail. So what we're going to be doing is generating code for a fairly famous machine. It's very, very widely used, called the Java Virtual Machine. Java, because it's designed for Java. Our language is like Java, so if it's good for Java, it should be good for us. Virtual means that it's not the machine you could actually build, you could actually buy from a vendor. Rather, it's something that, through programming, you give the illusion of having this machine available. It seems kind of odd you do that. You know, why would you generate code for a fake machine, as it were? But the advantage of this is the Java Virtual Machine is owned by nobody, and therefore there's no proprietary rights. And as a result, Java is available on virtually every platform you can imagine. Certainly all the major operating systems on desktops, laptops, smartphones, they're available not just for Intel machines, but also for machines that run the ARM processors. Those are for most part done for tablets or for smartphones, and any others that may come up. So it's a virtual guarantee that Java infrastructure will be available on any and all platforms, which means you can do your project virtually anywhere, and your compiler, once it's running, could actually run on virtually any platform. Turns out also we're generating code for the Java Virtual Machine, which means any place where a Java program could be run, a CSX program could be run. Now, honestly, you're probably not going to replace Java with CSX. CSX is more or less a subset of Java. But now you own the compiler, you own the language, and you can change things. In some sense, now you're the master rather than the slave, in the sense that if you always thought it was crazy that a language did something this way, how much better would be to do it someplace else. Now it's up to you. You change the language, you change whatever type checking and code generation is necessary, but all of a sudden the program works your way. And as a result, this would be a good thing for experimenting. What would happen if, would this work, would that work, etc. And that's one of the contexts in which the JVM is be used, is experimenting with various innovations to see how well they would work. You also, although I'm not going to emphasize it here, have access to the vast infrastructure of Java classes. You already know from having taken 367, if you did, there are all sorts of classes out there that do hash tables, symbol tables, arrays, lists, queues, decks, any things like that. There's also things that do very fancy I/O. There are libraries out there that essentially allow you to get into wireless access, to do essentially an IP connection, and all that is in theory available. So, I mean, you'd have to play a little bit, of course, with it, but it gives you an entree into this vast world of software that's already out there. And in many cases, using existing software is a great way to get something done and done quickly. In situations on some languages, you can get up and actually start exporting a web page in less than a page of code. And still, you know, that's not all of it, because you have to still have access to the internet. Most internet connections, probably even here, it's an anomaly that the speed in which you can download information is way better than the speed in which you can upload information. And in fact, most of the major providers do it intentionally that way, so they can charge you way more if you're a major content provider. Now, I don't know, in this case, do a lot of people link into Epic's internet just to get documentation or other things like that? To the extent they do that, they'd have to have wide bandwidth. But this is the sort of thing you can experiment with. So I thought that's a good selling point. What's odd about a Java virtual machine, particularly if you're familiar with real computers, the kind that are actually physically available inside of laptop or smartphone or whatever, is that we actually use an operand stack rather than registers. Now, that's kind of a little trick because actually implementations use registers. If you remember from the mini lecture I gave or from your reading, registers are of relatively few locations built directly on the CPU that are extremely, extremely fast. Old machines like the x86 have as few as 8 registers. Newer machines have 16, 32, 64. Some have 128. Some experimental ones have thousands of machines, thousands of registers, but they are the anomaly. The trouble is, if different processors have a different number of registers, how many registers should a virtual machine have? The way they solved it is, we have as many as you care to access, but we don't call them registers. We call them an operand stack, and like typical stacks, they get pushed and popped, and there's some notion of a top. But it actually turns out there's an effective way to say, if I have an operand stack that contains 7 values, why would it contain 7 values? Well, you may be set up to call a method that has 7 parameters. The way you pass parameters is you push them on the operand stack until all 7 are available. Then you transfer control to the subprogram saying, okay, here are your parameters, do your thing. They'll be removed from the stack, and if there's a result coming back, it'll be left on the stack. So it works out very cleanly. And those 7 parameters could then be mapped effectively to registers in an implementation. But how it's done depends on the actual machines. So an implementation of the JVM for an x86 would be different than one for an ARM processor, for example, which has typically more registers because it's more modern. So we have an operand stack, and that's something, when we actually start talking about code in just a moment, everything's going to be stack-oriented. And when I say stack, I mean operand stack. Last lecture, I talked about using a stack for frames. That also exists, but that's a separate stack. So just like as you may have more than one symbol table, you can have more than one stack. In our implementation, we'll have a stack for frames. That means recursion will work pretty normally. And in fact, it's entirely possible for CSX programs to be recursive. You can do the trivial sort of things like factorial, or you can do more elaborate sorts of recursion just to test things out. So that stack will exist, but it'll also be an operand stack that says, I want to push down as many operands on the stack as an operation needs and then access them. So as I said, all computation is through the operand stack. That means our instructions will never say use register 1 or use register 7. Rather, it'll say do something always relative to the top of the stack. The stack can grow and shrink. Some computations may need only 1 or 2 stack locations. Others may need several. If you have a method that contains n parameters, for sure you'll need n stack locations because you'll have to push the parameters, make the call, and then resume calculation. If you have a particularly complex calculation, you may need several registers, several stack locations, and that's something we'll have to anticipate when we're actually doing our designing of code. So just to give you a flavor of that, what are some of the common operations that we'll see when we're generating code? One of them is how do we get information onto the stack? We load it. So load operations will always be relative to the stack. We'll say, here's a memory location. It might be a global location, or it might be a location inside of a frame. Please grab the data that's stored in our program and put it on the stack. And that's what loads will do. Stores will take a value sitting on the stack, remove it, and drop it back into memory, either into a global location, like a field, or into a local location, like a local variable inside of a method. Computations will take their operands from the stack, do a computation, and restore onto the stack the result. So if, for example, I'm adding A and B, at the point I do the add, A and B's values will be sitting on top of the stack. The add operation will take those 2 values, do the actual computation that an add represents, and put the sum back on the stack. So again, it's always very straightforward. Everything's relative to the stack. Calls, as I mentioned a moment ago, push their parameters. Every call knows how many parameters it has, pushes them onto the stack, transfers control. The subprogram actually makes those parameters look like local variables in the frame. they're used for computation. If I return nothing, nothing's put on the stack. If I return a value from a function, the return value is left on top of the stack. Conditional branches, which allow us to do things like loops or ifs, do a test relative to one or two or perhaps even three values sitting on top of the stack. So I can say if the top stack value is negative, do this. If it's zero, do that. If it's non-zero, do that. Or I can even have operations that say, take the top two values and compare them. If they're equal, do a branch or not. If they're not equal, do a branch or not, etc. So conditional flow, which is needed for ifs and loops and any complex calculation, are all relative to the stack. What about data? Well, we'll have two kinds of data. We'll have static data, which means there's only one occurrence of that in the entire program. That will be a field inside of a class. So our fields inside classes are what Java calls static fields. But they're there, and therefore if a class wants to have some variables inside it to operate on, they'll be allocated statically and accessed by their name, or actually by a slightly mangled version of their name. We can have also local variables inside of a frame, and when a method starts, it may have some local declarations. Those will be anticipated by our compilation, and as many slots for local variables as are needed will be allocated inside that frame. And when the method is called, that data will automatically be made available. It'll exist while the method is executing. Upon return, the frame is popped, and all that local data is released. For our purposes, Java has a wide variety of built-in types, but we don't want to get too deeply into that. So for our purposes, we'll use two kinds of Java types. For the scalars, that is integer, char, and boolean, those will be implemented as integers in the Java framework. And that obviously makes sense. Obviously, a character will fit in an integer, a boolean, which is 0 or 1, will fit in an integer, and an integer is an integer. We'll also need to use what Java calls references. Remember, those are essentially pointers to a heap-allocated object, and those will be used for arrays. Remember that arrays are dynamically allocated. You say, please create me an object containing 10 integers. That's a size 10 array. And also, strings are implemented as objects, and we have string literals. So if we print a string, for example, we'll really create a string object. Which kind? The standard kind. The kind that's built in Java. So our strings will be no different than the strings that real Java programs use. That, by the way, means that any method that you have in the Java library that wants to use a string will work on our strings as well as standard Java strings. And what happens then is you use a reference to the string, because the string may be very large, and that's used to access, for example, in print statements, to say follow the reference to the string and access it for printing purposes as if it were a standard Java string. Now, to simplify our creation of programs, we'll create our program symbolically, and I'll be showing you an example of that in a minute. That means that we'll actually not actually encode a program as bits, zeros, or ones. It turns out a program called Jasmine will do that for us. Instead, what we'll do is each instruction we want to generate will simply be a line printed into a file. And I really mean printed, printed using print statements. And I'll show you an example. So if I want to do an ad, for example, I'll write a line that essentially says do an ad. In JVM terminology, it's actually called an iAd. I for integer, so do an integer add, take the operands from the stack, put the result on the stack. More complex operations will take perhaps a label. So if I want to do a store, I can say store the value on the stack into this particular label. That would store the value into a field. So what we'll do is we'll actually create these in readable form and feed them into Jasmine, which is the last step of the process. That will take what is essentially a JVM program. That is a program whose instructions are no longer Java, no longer CSX, but rather real JVM instructions, just like you would see in a textbook, and convert them into a .class file, which is exactly the format that Java creates when it compiles a program. So remember, if you ever use Java C, the Java compiler, it takes a Java source program and creates something of the form class name .class. And this will be exactly the same format that Jasmine creates. So all of a sudden that our outputs will be exactly the same as standard Java, which means we can run them on any Java platform we want. So Jasmine will do some of the work of detail type stuff, figuring out that this many bits represent that and that many bits represent that. We could do all that if we had more time, but we don't. So we'll use the tools at hand. It also makes debugging way easier because I can actually look and say, oh, you're trying to do a store where you should try to be doing a load. And if these were bits, that'd be hard for me to recognize or hard for the TA, but much easier if it's in symbolic form. So Java then is a symbolic assembler for the JVM. It takes an input file whose lines are JVM code in a particular format, but a format that's pretty straightforward. And we'll create those instructions by essentially just doing plain old print statements to a particular file. The file will be the actual Jasmine file that we'll actually create. So typically what we'll do is we'll create a file name, whatever the class is, and suffix it with a .j, j in this case for Jasmine. It will then take the instructions, take the declarations, and create the .class file that we'll need. Well, we're going to generate code, so the question is, what code do I generate? Well, there are two ways to approach that. One of them is, I will show you, or the TA will, through these notes we have. So you say, well, if I'm doing this computation, what instruction should I use? That's essentially what these code generation notes are telling us. It says, if you're translating this AST node, here's the instruction you'd like to generate. In some cases, there are alternatives, but the instruction I suggest is a valid one and will work. But it turns out there's another alternative, and one that I've used on occasion when I was a little bit stuck, and namely is I'll ask Java. It turns out Java has a built-in mechanism that says, if I have a .class file created by a Java compiler, so what I can do is I can create a Java program that's extremely close to the CSX program I want to get some hint on, and I go ahead and compile it using the Java C. I guess you could also use Eclipse, and it'd create a .class file. And you have a command line that says Java P, it takes the minus C, and the XXX is the name of the class file that already exists. And what it does is go into the class file and list it out in a human readable format. So to say inside this class file, you have a translation for class so-and-so, it's got this method and that, and these methods have these particular instructions. So if you make the program very small, focusing only on what you want to know, so you say, how in the world does this thing do a compare instruction? So if I want to say, how does it do I equal J, I double equal J? You could have a little instruction in your Java program that says, some Boolean variable gets A equal equal B. Go ahead and translate it using Java C or Eclipse or whatever you want. Run that command line, and it would actually take the file that you created, xxx.class, and put it on printable form. Not quite the same as Jasmine, but pretty close. And you could then see what Java decided to do. And you say to yourself, well, it's good enough for Java, it's good enough for me. You may or may not need to do that, but if you ever feel stuck, this is sort of a way out of finding somebody who's an expert. And certainly, everything we have in CSX has a cognate in Java. So that's a doable thing. Now, the question is, how do you actually run that command line? If you happen to have a Mac, it's pretty easy. You just go into terminal mode. Remember that you go into applications and there's an application that has utilities. And one of the utilities is a terminal. And the terminal then lets you actually execute commands. Java, Java C, Java P are all available in Macs. And that's there. Now, I believe at least a couple of people who run Windows have told me it's possible to run Java and Java C at the command line in a Windows system. Is that correct? Yeah. James, you right. So maybe one of you, for people who are running Windows but aren't familiar how to do it, if you haven't already, submit something to Piazza saying, here's how you do that. If you had a class file named xxx.class and you wanted to run this magic command to see what was inside xxx on a Windows 7 or a Windows 10 system, here's how you do it. Is it a very complex thing to do?
No. The main thing you have to do is set your environment variable path.
Okay, right. If you get the time and you know you care to make a submission, that I'm sure the other class people who are running Windows would appreciate it. So I'm saying it used to be, I know in the old systems, you used to be able to get into DOS, but I guess DOS no longer exists on advanced Windows. Is that correct? There's sort of a legacy. Yeah. used to be named DOS, you know, is kind of a Unix-like system, and you could actually go down there and do things at that level. But I think Windows has pulled back on that. It turns out that Mac hasn't as yet. I hope they never do. It's deep down in Mac is just some version of Unix with really, really fancy GUIs to make it all look pretty and, like, forgetting that there's really a Unix-like system down there. You may not even need to do this, but, I mean, it's always good to have the basic commands down there so that if Eclipse is being unhelpful, say, Eclipse, I don't need you. I've got a perfectly good alternative. I'll go in and just run Java C or Java P and do it that way. Eclipse is, for the most part, very useful, but sometimes it can get in one's way. So we don't necessarily need to worry about that. Also, the build that I provide, remember, there is a startup package for 5. What it does is actually does code generation for a CSX Lite. And many of the code generation routines used in Lite can be carried forward either exactly or very closely to what you're doing for CSX. All that means is how I would translate, for example, an integer literal in Lite would be the same thing as the way I would do it in full CSX, because it's a very straightforward translation. So straightforward that you could hardly imagine any alternative as being better. But in terms of build.xml, we have now not one, not two, but 3 different test alternatives. The first one test does a full test on one fixed program. That's typically used when you first load the thing to make sure that it's compiled properly, Eclipse builds everything. So you've done that before on assignments 2, 3, and 4, where you simply, and 1, I guess, where you simply take what I've given you, run the build, and it goes ahead and tests it to make sure everything compiled cleanly. There's also something which I know many of you are using, and I think it's wise that you do so, called Test 1, which allows you to pop up a GUI and simply type in or click the program you want to test. But now we've got a problem. We're generating code, and the code we generate will not necessarily be a complete executable program from the word go. It's rather much like being on campus here where they have buildings coming up. Driving in, I saw that besides the building, which I'm told are very close to being completed or perhaps actually occupied, it looks like there's something new coming in because I saw some girders and floorboards and something. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? What building is that, just for my curiosity? Nobody knows? Oh, more than one. Okay. It's the one coming in from the north end. It's coming in from the north end of Yoda. So it's across the road from, I guess, the Wizards, what are they called? Wizards Palace or whatever? Alice?
Yeah, if you look at the interesting fact, if there's a tower crane for the building, the name of the building is on the crane.
Really? I never stopped to do that.
Yeah,
that's so not for us. I assume that's for the...
Like Park G5, if it's the parking garage.
But yeah.
Like all of the buildings, if there's a tower crane, the name is on the crane.
Yeah. There must be... These builders here must be like spending a lifetime here. It's like back in the Middle Ages when they were building these great cathedrals. People would literally spend their entire working lives building some cathedral. It would take literally decades, perhaps even hundreds of years. So if you didn't complete it, your son or daughter might be on the project to do the next and the next. And I imagine they might have a similar thing here. Wherever the building companies are, they already have their children and grandchildren lined up to do whatever succeeding buildings we have. So just as you're retiring, they'll be bringing in new buildings. But at any rate, we have a similar problem to what they do, namely the building's complete, you can't occupy it. If you've generated some code but not complete code, you want to look at it, but you don't want to try to execute it because it can't possibly work because it's incomplete. So, for example, you might initially start doing very simple sort of code generation, like doing addition and subtraction, loading, storing, assignments. And you'd have a little bit of code that says, oh, I can see that, loaded A, loaded B, did an add, and stored it. That's the equivalent of C gets A plus B. And I can look at that and say, hey, yeah, that looks pretty good. I think that's probably right. But you can't execute that in isolation because it doesn't have the class declared, doesn't have the methods declared, it doesn't have all the frameworks you needed. So what you can do is we have test one. It will show you the generated code, but it won't try to execute it. But of course, at some point, you'll assume everything is in place. And there's a second alternative called test two that will actually go ahead and assemble the generate the program through your compiler, assemble it through Jasmine, create a .class file, and then run the thing as if it were a Java program, and you can actually see some output coming through. And I'll have actually an example of that just a moment. So those are the 3 alternatives. You'll probably use test one for most of the time you're working on the project. But at some point, when you think you have a simple but complete program, you want to run it. And there's nothing as cool as having your very first program run and actually has it do something, if only something as simple as Hello World. So you could actually create something even simpler than I'll show you. And in fact, let me show you this just to give you a little sense of what's going on. Come on. Oh. Yeah. So what this is, if you have the assignment here, and I'm going to actually blow this up a little bit, not quite that much, is what this is a before and after in the sense that here's a very simple CSX program. And I've been talking about generating Java code, so I'm going to show you a little bit of this. And what I'll do is actually step you through the structure that we're generating. So this thing is a simple and valid CSX program. It's got a single method called main. And again, this is not quite Hello World because I wanted to show a little bit of arithmetic. So what it does is it has an integer A. It reads A in from what? Standard input, just like Java would if you had a Java program that was reading from standard input. It does print a string literal answer. It does a trivial computation of doubling A and adding 1, and then prints out new line just to show how to handle characters. So this is the program that you put in, and this is what Jasmine might get as its input. Notice it's very different, because now this is all in terms of JVM. And let me give you a little highlights, and we'll get back to this. First of all, any command that begins with a dot is not a JVM instruction. Rather, it's a directive to Jasmine. So sort of thing like a declaration or a comment or something. And in this case, it says, well, what do we know in Java about all programs? Programs are classes. So if we're generating a Java program, we're really generating a Java class. So it says, okay, here's the class I'm going to generate. And it says, generate me a class, and it's going to be public. We're making all our things public, and we could make them private, but for our purposes, public is fine. And please give it the name simple. Why simple? Well, here's the case that in the original program, I gave it the name simple. If I decided to name it Charlie, it would have a Charlie. If I decided to name it something naughty, it would be named something naughty. We don't even have parental controls in here, so I'm sure you're not allowed to use naughty names in your programming, and you probably shouldn't do it in CSX either. But in this case, if it's a valid identifier, it just carries it forward. And notice this is important because that means when the class is created, it'll be simple.class. It'll be the output of this. So it's generating class simple. By the way, a semicolon and things following it are the equivalent of a double slash comment. They chose not to use double slash, they use semicolon. So this is an end of line comment. So it says, okay, we're creating a public class named Simple. Classes always have this property that they have parents. If nothing else, your parent is the superclass object. So it says, what's my superclass? In this case, I'm not going to try to have a class structure. So I'll make my parent the ultimate parent, which is object. And the notation for that is java/lang/object. What happens here is that in this notation, because dot is used for things like directives, instead of using a dot as Java would use, it substitutes a slash. So you can read java/lang/object as java.lang.object. And if you read your documentation, in the package java.lang is where object really is located. So this is the standard object that's the parent of all classes. And we're simply saying here, the superclass is object. You got to have a superclass, so we choose the obvious one. This, by the way, will be very standard. So what your program will do is just generate this as what's called boilerplate. As I guess that's attorney's terminology, but it means that it's standard from contract to contract or agreement to agreement. And I'm sure, I don't know, anybody here in sales, they probably make customer signs or things like this. We agree not to disclose company secrets and not to do this and not to do that. That's boilerplate. And in fact, the only thing that will change is the name of the class. Everything else will be standard in those first two lines. And we just take the name of the class from the program. Where do we get it? Remember that CSX programs always begin with a class and they have a name. So whatever name was in the program you're compiling will be the name we use, which is, of course, what you'd expect. I then have a comment just to remind us what's going on. We have a slight problem, but we're going to turn a problem into an advantage, namely, standard Java programs begin with class main, whose type is void as a return, and it takes an array of strings as a parameter. Remember, that's so that when you call a Java program, you can put some parameters on the command line. They'll be read as strings and processed. Well, we have a simpler rule than that, but all real Java programs have to have this class. So we're going to create a dummy one whose purpose is primarily just to call our main, the simpler one. It'll turn out also we'll be able to use this if we have some initialization that has to be done, and it has to be done prior to execution. So it says, JVM interpreters, like the Java in, you know, not Java C, but Java, the one that executes .class files, say, well, I'm going to look for main of string arrays. Well, we're going to create one of those for it. So we're going to say, in this particular case, .method says, I'm going to create a brand new method. And I'm going to give its declaration and then information about what's in the method. So it's going to be public. It's going to be static. It's going to be main. The format they use is the return type comes at the end of the declaration, not at the beginning. Remember, this is that name mangling I talked about. But in this particular case, we're going to have a return type too, V meaning void. This business inside, the L here to the semicolon, is a very odd form of quotation. It turns out in this particular case, we won't always have a primitive type like integer or char. We may have something like object, or in this case, string, that's sitting somewhere in the Java libraries. So the way it works is L, I don't know what L actually stands for. I consider it to be lookup. So it says, please look up java.lang.string. That's exactly where the standard string is declared in Java land. And the semicolon just ends it. So think of that as odd quotes, where L is the left quote and semicolon is the right quote. And everything in between there is a path name to some pre-declared Java entity, like strings or a class object. So this is the header. Notice that what happens is each header has a corresponding end. So where I just drew that bracket is the entire body of this particular method. It's a very simple one. And what's it going to do? Well, invoke static is the terminology in JVM to do a call to a method. It's a static method, but remember, in our case, all our methods are static methods. That is, they exist as single methods, and they don't take a class object as a parameter. So it says, please go ahead and invoke simple. Where did simple come from? That's the name of our class. We plug it in. Slash means dot. So it says, go into class simple, the one we're creating, and find a method called main of no arguments and whose return type is void. That's where our program will effectively start. It says, please call that. After it's executed, I'm all done. Return, as you might imagine, says return the method to the caller. So in this case, it's the original call, so it returns back to the operating system or to the interpreter. This limit stack is something you have to give the system to help it out a little bit. It says, I'm going to tell you a limit to how deep the stack is going to be. In this case, the limit is only two entries. This is the operand stack. In other cases, we may need more. I'm going to explain to you how we could compute it, or what we're going to actually do is we're going to pick a number so large that it's going to be safe for anything but the most extreme programs. And we'll get into that. This is the way we forewarn the system that, yes, I'm going to use the stack and it's going to be dynamic, but it's never going to get deeper than a particular limit. And this is something where we'll have to estimate what it is, and I'll get down to that a little later. So this whole thing is the entryway that the Java execution system says, okay, I'm going to start running here. The first thing I'm going to do is call the user's program main, which is where the user expected program execution to begin. So that effectively is going to take me to the method I named main in my program. So I have a couple of blank lines, you know, it's just for readability. And it says, here's a second method, dot method, and it's going to go for essentially the whole length of the program. And this is going to have the entire content of the method. Notice this has got way more lines than the program we had in it. That's exactly why we have compilers. Machine language, be it JVM or any other thing, tends to be very detailed and very tedious. People want to see higher level instructions. So typically a program that might have 5 or 10 lines, our program here had 1, 2, 3 real lines and a couple of lines of just declarations. And this ends up generating at least three or four times that many instructions because the instructions are all very low level. But of course, that's exactly what we expect compilers to do. Real machines have very primitive instructions, things like load, store, add, subtract, multiply, branch to a different address. And the reason they keep them so simple is if they're simple, they can be implemented in such a way that the program runs really fast. That's an insight I think you've already gotten, but many people using computers don't understand, is that programs run really fast, but they run really fast through very simple instructions. How fast do they run? Well, again, a good way to figure it is when you buy a processor or buy a computer, if you do your homework, a processor has some information. It says it's got an Intel so-and-so, and they typically give you its speed. And these days, speeds are typically measured in gigahertz. Now, what we were saying, what 2 or 3 gigahertz is typical for a processor you might buy these days? Yeah. I think the one I have in there is around 2 gigahertz. Now, giga, of course, is that fancy name for billion. But the way to read that is that if you have your processor running at full speed, it can be executing as many instructions as the hertz that you have in the processor. So that means your computer, and again, a very simple one, something that's only, you know, in a MacBook Air, you know, not top of the line by any means, could be generating 2 billion instructions per second, or executing them. Well, it doesn't matter very much if these instructions are simple and fairly numerous. If I'm doing 2 billion of them in a second, that means I'm going to be able to run a lot of instructions really fast. And that's one of the unexpected things. You start with very high-level programs that do fairly fancy operations, and they end up being reduced down to these tiny little instructions that do nothing more complex than load something, add something, compare something, branch something. It does a lot of them, but it's so darn fast that it still gives the effect of running your program virtually instantaneously. So that's just kind of a sidelight. So it's going to say, okay, let's go ahead and look back to our original program. It turns out integer A didn't have an initialization, so that doesn't generate any code at all. What it did is it says, go inside my method and reserve some space for A. So it's like your travel bureau or something saying, you're going to be, you know, in Chicago or wherever on such and such a day. Please book a room for so-and-so. I assume they book you in hotels. They don't put you in the YMCAs or YWCAs or something. I don't know how cheap they are. Or Motel 6s, right? I mean, those. If you're paying your own money, that's one thing. If you're spending somebody else's money, it ought to be at least a Sheraton or something above. I don't know. You're laughing, but maybe. So at any rate, integer A does not generate any code at all. If it had been initialized, it might. But in this case, we didn't. So that gets down to, we had an instruction that says, read me an integer from standard input. And now we're going to actually start generating some code for that. The way we're going to do read integers is we're going to have a little library of CSX library routines, just like Java does. So Java has a huge number of libraries. We have a tiny little library that is already available. So if you look at Project 5, it's sitting there, and it's called CSX Lib for Library, and it'll have the various utility routines that we need for CSX. By the way, if you want some extra credit, you could add some more of those and have some extra fancy things done. What could you do for extra credit? Well, for example, you could read or write more types. At present, we read only a couple of things. I think you can read a Boolean. No, you read a char and an integer, and that's it. You might be able to read a string into perhaps a character array or something. Whatever. One way of doing that would be essentially create a little library routine that does all the hard work and just interface to a call of it that would actually do the reading and produce the particular results. So that's just a possibility. In our case, what we're doing is we're saying go into CSX Lib, and I've created a little routine, and you can look at the source. I mean, it's pretty much what you'd expect, that reads an integer. It takes no parameters, but it returns an I. So this is the equivalent of go to library routine, execute it, tell the Java system to read an integer from standard input and put it on the operand stack. So this call reads an integer and puts it on the operand stack. I stands for integer, store stands for store. So it says, please store. But what is zero? Well, zero is the location I assign to integer A. The way it assigns integers is the way a lot of organizations assign rooms or addresses or something. Starts at 1, but in our case, being a computer, we start at 0. So the first integer variable gets location 0, the next gets 1, the next gets 2, etc. And the numbers get bigger and bigger the more variables I declare. In this case, I only have 1a, so it gets location 0. So store a really means store into the frame into location 0, which is reserved for variable a. So now I've read something into a and stored it. So hey, that's the entire translation for that. So in this case, reading a just took a couple of instructions, a call to a library routine and a store. Pretty straightforward. The next one is get down to the print. But the print's more complex because I'm printing out three different things. First a string, then do a computation and print its result, and then print a character. I could, by the way, have made new line a string, but I wanted to show I could also print characters. Remember, a new line character or a string containing one character are pretty much the same as far as output's concerned. They'll both generate a new line and force the output to, you know, end the current line and go to the new one. So it says print. The first thing is a string. Well, how did we store strings in CSX? We stored them in quoted form. And the question is, why did we store them in quoted form? Well, now you're going to know. What happens is the JVM and Jasmine want the strings that you want printed out in quoted form, including new lines, which escapes, which I don't show. So the reason why I didn't strip the quotes from answer equals in the CSX compiler is because Jasmine will do it for us. So what I do is I execute the instruction LDC. That stands for load constant. In this case, it's a constant string. And then I go ahead and give it the actual string literal. So what Jasmine will do is go into Java, create a Java object of type string, initialize to answer equals with the blanks and all that, and put a reference to that on the stack. So I'll actually have a reference to a valid Java string sitting on the stack. Load constant does that. And I even have a comment here. It says, what I'm going to get ready to do is I'm going to call print string. So I'm going to call invoke static. That says call a method. The method is, CSX Live. Oops. CSX Live dot print string. That's a routine that printed strings that I wrote in CSX. It says it takes a parameter that's a standard kind of Java string, and it returns void. So the effect of pushing the string and calling that routine does the first part of the print. Did I get a question, or did I get it? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think I will as long as possible. Good idea. So in this case, I did the first print. The next thing is I need to do a computation. So let's see how I do that. That's one of the first things, by the way, we'll cover in today's lecture once we get done with this. It says, well, first of all, I have to compute 2 times A plus 1. Now, remember, your parser has already done some analysis of that. And it said, what is 2A plus 1? Well, remember, it's multiply 2 and A and then plus 1. And I know that because remember that operator precedence business we did in parsing said multiplication has priority over addition. So in this case, it says do the addition first, get 2a, then add on a 1. So it says I'm going to first generate code to do that subtree. This is, remember, this is essentially a binary op node, and it's got two children, one of which is an int literal and the other of which is a name. But at this stage, we're looking at it symbolically. So it says, okay, I'm going to load the constant 2. Where? Onto the stack. Next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to do an integer load from slot 0. Remember, slot 0 is assigned to A, so it essentially says load A, where? Onto the stack. So now I have the literal 2 and the value of A that was read a couple of lines up, whatever the user typed in. And I'm going to do a multiplication. It turns out MUL stands for multiply. I don't know why they don't call it full multiply. Whatever. I means integer. So do an integer style multiply. This thing will take the top 2 elements off the operand stack, multiply them, put the product back on the stack. So when this thing is done, these 3 instructions have computed 2 times A. What it then does is, well, now I have to do the addition of 1. So it loads a constant onto the stack. So now top of the stack is 1. Below it is the product of 2A, 2 times A. And it says, now do an integer add. Now the top of the stack has the entire computation of 2A plus 1 on the stack. And it's then going to say, okay, take the value on the stack that turns out to be an integer and print it. How do I do that? I invoke static, call a method, CSXLive.printInt, takes an integer parameter from the stack and returns void. So that effectively does the print of the integer, therefore doing the second of my write operations. Finally, I get to the third one, and I say load constant 10. Can anybody guess where 10 came from? 10 is the character code, the ASCII character code for the tick backslash n. So remember, new line's an invisible character, but all characters have a character code. Since we're working in terms of integers, I'm going to put on the integer character code, which, of course, in terms of the internals of a character, would be the same. So I put that on the stack. So that's the same thing as pushing tick new line. The reason we did it that way is you probably have already converted the new line character to its integer equivalent, and now we'd use that. I then call invoke static. I call library of print char. That takes a character from the stack, top of the stack, but its character form and the integer form are the same. Returns void. That does the final print. I then do a return. That's implicit. Remember, I had some questions on assignment 4. I said there's implicit return at the end of the body of each method. People said, why was that in there? Well, it was in there to remind me to generate a return, even if the user did not say return. If the user had said return, I would have generated return. In fact, I would have done something fairly silly. What would you imagine I would have done if, instead of just ending it as I did, I put a return in there, which, of course, would be perfectly valid. If I did that, what do you suppose my code generator would have done? It would have generated two consecutive returns. There's the old joke about somebody who's so conservative, I guess a gentleman, that he would wear a belt and braces, suspenders, at the same time, because he wanted to make sure if one failed, the other would still be in place. So I don't know whether you're going to give me a return or not. I could check for that. That makes life more tedious. So all I do is put one return in there if you generate it, and put one return in there even if you don't. The second return, of course, would never be used, but it would never be harmful. By the way, there's a chance for a minor optimization. Not a big deal, but you know, if you wanted to make your program slightly more elegant, you could somehow set it up, if you did write analysis, that if the last instruction you executed was not a return, insert one there. I'm not saying you necessarily need to, but that's something there. Finally, we have to give the assembler, Jasmine, a little bit of extra instruction. We said, what's the maximum stack depth you're going to have? Well, it's way less than 25. I picked out 25 as something that almost certainly is overkill, but is safe. That means that in this little program, I never push so often that I had 25 or more than 25 elements on the stack. You could actually analyze a program to figure out how many stack locations it will need, but that's a fairly detailed analysis. I'll probably talk about that on the final lecture, if only because if you look at old exams, I sometimes ask the question, how would you do it? In this case, we're overestimating just to be safe. But it'd be nice if we had a systematic way of getting a precise number. I also have to say, how many locals did I declare? That turns out to be easy. Every time I do a declare of a local, I increment a counter. So in this case, up top, I saw one declare, so I had one local. And I said, oh, by the way, I had one local. That's so that Jasmine knows enough to leave room for one local addressed at position 0. If I had more locals, the count might be 2 or 3 or whatever. And then finally, end method. And that's a little bit of flavor of what your code generator is going to do as it walks the AST for a simple program like this or a more complex one. It'll end up generating actual print instructions, which will be interpreted by Jasmine as JVM instructions and will then assemble and build a program. So inside of our build, what actually happens is actually we've gone ahead and built this file. It would end up in a file called simple.j. Simple because that's the name of the class, J because it's in Jasmine format. I call Jasmine. It would then verify this is the correct program. I haven't made any mistakes in terms of doing JVM. And if so, it would create a file called simple.class. exactly the same format as standard Java, and therefore to execute it, I would simply call Java and simple, and it would then go into execution, read from standard input and all the rest, and print a standard output. And that's just an overview of where we're going. So any questions or comments on that? By the way, at some point towards the end of the semester, when you actually have your program mostly working, you might want to try that and see if your output, it won't generate the comments, of course, but generates essentially the same instructions as I suggested. Or you could even try simpler things and see if you get a subset of them. So any questions on that? Okay, let's go on then. And what I'm going to do is get out your copy of Code Generation Notes Part 1. And I'll see if I've got one of them for myself. Ah, there they are. And what I'll do is I'll just bring it up on the screen so that we can talk about it from there. So what I'll do is simply scroll through this, and what you want to do, let's kill this guy, sorry. And you can there make little notes or something as we go along. But essentially what's going to happen is, as I mentioned, is when we generate we start doing code generation, we're going to have to give a name of a file that we're going to actually go ahead and generate the output into. Remember, we decided, and I think it's set up in the startup package I gave you for 5, that what we'll do is we'll get the name of the class and add onto it a .j to say we're generating a Jasmine-style format. So what you do here is we would actually create a print stream that will essentially be associated with the name, whatever the class happens to be, .j. And again, you'll be able to see exactly how to do that by simply looking at the CSX component that we have in a startup for number 5 that already has that in there. So what's going to happen is we're going to start code generation by pointing to the root of the AST that's already been built and type checked. And what we're going to do is walk the tree one more time. Previously, we walked the tree to do unparsing. Then we walked the tree to do type checking. Now we're going to walk the tree to do code generation. And effectively, whenever we visit a node, we're going to say, what JVM code should we generate for this particular kind of node? Something like an int literal, I'd have a very simple translation. Something like a method call or method declaration, we'll have a more complex translation, but we'll visit the subcomponents and translate them one by one. So what I'll be doing in the notes is starting out with some fairly simple translations, things like variables, literals, operations and assignments. And then we'll work up to more complex things like loops and conditionals, I/O, and eventually we'll get to method declarations and method calls. And interestingly enough, and this is one of the amazing things, is that you spent all this work in assignment number 4 to make things like overloading work. But when we get to 5, it doesn't matter. Overloading is handled trivially, because guess what? The JVM does exactly what many of you did to handle overloaded names. Namely, it does name mangling. And the name mangling I suggested was essentially the one that Java already uses. So if you've gone ahead and you had an overloaded routine that was mangled with respect to the number of parameters it had or names of the parameters, you're going to essentially use that same encoding. Let me finish. You're going to essentially use that same format when you actually go ahead and make the generation of the call and the generation of the method name in the actual translation. So this name mangling actually is something that's doubly useful, both for checking and for code gen. So that was our little beeper there. So let's take about a 10-minute break, and we'll start getting into parts 1 and then parts 2 and talking about how these things are translated. So it's 6:30, and we'll start again at 6:40.